General Sir David Thorne, Reel 1. General, can you tell me if there was a family background or tradition of military service?
Yes, there was. If I start by saying that when I and my twin brother went to St Edward's, Oxford, we didn't really know what we were going to do with our lives, but it became clear fairly early on that my twin brother Mike was going to go into the family law firm, which was then Little Welsford Thorne Farms, and that therefore I needed a slot elsewhere. And my uncle had been in the Royal Norfolk Regiment, my grandfather had been in the Royal Norfolk Regiment, and my uncle had actually commanded the 1st Battalion. And so, almost by default, I thought, right, here we go. And so I applied to go in the regiment and found my way to Sandhurst. And I should add that very early on I got indications that from the regimental point of view, my uncle in particular had been very highly thought of within the regiment. And so I got welcoming messages from various officers in the regiment, one indeed from Korea, from a chap called Bob Hammond, who was on board the aircraft carrier out there. And so in a sense, I passaged into the regiment because my twin brother had an alternative thing which he needed to do.
How old were you when you made this decision that you were going to follow?
16 and a half. And if I could sort of take it up from there, the 9th of Foot, as it was then, was like all good county regiments, it was a family. And so the moment people knew that I was coming into it, you know, there was a sort of general nod of approval and little messages came through, which was a great encouragement. And so I never had any doubt that I was going to be 9th of Foot, Rule Britannia, and so on. It then followed that, Kirsty and I, that my brother joined in national service before going to Oxford and got a scholarship to Worcester College. And so liked the regiment and all its life that he gave up his scholarship, he gave up Oxford, and he stayed in the regiment. So when I came to the regiment with an uncle whose memory was good and a grandfather who, I'll come back to that. I had twin brother and myself unusually allowed to be in the same battalion of the regiment, and to carry that family description a bit further. My twin brother and I commanded our battalions, 1st and 2nd battalions, and then the Royal Anglian Regiment, at the same time, which is probably a unique circumstance. I think it was at that time. I think it's very, very unusual situation. And when I came back from the Falkland Islands in 1983, I received a message from regimental headquarters to say that an old soldier of the 2nd, 6th Norfolk Cyclists, my grandfather's unit, an old soldier who'd been the Sergeant Major to my grandfather, and he must have been a very young Sergeant Major, had bought a Sergeant Major's cane with a silver top and a tail on it to give to IHQ, to give to me as a sort of a present from him because of what I'd done in the Falkland Islands. It's amazing how, again, within the regiment, within the family of the county and the family of the regiment, these lovely moments occur. And what made me very sad was no one kept a name of this soldier, and I could never find out who he was because it was, I'd gone to enormous lengths to find him and thank him. So we were a true, and are, my son's in the regiment, in the 1st Battalion. He'd actually be serving at the moment with the Special Forces, but he's 1st Battalion man, Royal Anglian, which is former Royal Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire, but Royal Norfolk. So that tradition was extremely powerful in my family.
Did you do any pre-military training while you were at school?
Yes, in the CCF at St Edward's, Oxford.
Can you remember the syllabus of training and what you learned there?
I can well recall having my first sort of court-martialable offence when I let a blank off and shot somebody in the fuzzy leg. And the officer in charge of the cadet corps, CCF, a chap called Platts Emmett, who was a great rower and a housemaster of Tilly's house, I had to be marched up in front of him to sort of get a little reprimand. I have to say, the training that we got was much more about corporate response to orders than too much of thinking deeply about war, and it was basic. It was march, there's a bit of shooting, an understanding of the importance of corporate discipline. Not a great deal more than that, but it was fun.
Did you do any tactical training? Field days and...
We did field days. My memories are more of the hilarity of it than the seriousness of it. But maybe that was the attitude of this sort of slightly larky attitude of the group of people that I tended to be with most at that time. I was very much a sportsman and not a scholar. Now. Indeed, it was one of the problems of St. Edward's, Oxford at that time, but also one of the joys for those who were good at sport, that you were either a blood or you were blood or a swat. A swat was looked on with grave concern by the large body who thought of themselves as bloods. And I have to say that I learnt the hard way that academic work is essential. Hard study is essential. And I learnt that more probably by the time I was a lieutenant. I began to study hard. I loved history then. Loved history. And really, that and then I did work hard both at school and ever since. History and poetry.
What about your twin? Was he similarly inclined in his interests?
Yes, I mean, we were both very good sportsmen. You know, I think so without sort of, that's not a boast. I mean, we both have played cricket for Norfolk and for the Army, and for school, obviously. We played squash. I played squash for the Army and the Command Services a little bit. Not the Command Services, sorry, squash. Command Services of cricket. And we got that at school. We have a very good eye, both of us. And so, you know, hockey, rugby, all that. So we had a very similar interest like that. But I'd say Mike was, he was more intelligent than me.
Yeah. Was he genuinely inclined towards the law at the time you were making these important decisions on what to do?
Yes, I think so. But he just learnt that the army was a lovely... Mm. A lovely life. And in a sense, he took a slightly romantic decision. That's consistent of him now, that he loves paintings and he collects paintings and he's interested in history because of the people, more than the politics, I think, of history. And so, no, we had a proud military tradition as well in the family. And
is there are there routes going back into Norfolk as a county?
Oh, yes. My grandfather... We used to be a family that, say, in the late 19th century, we owned and created what is now... It used to be Thornsbury, now... it became Newkes's. So it's Nine Elms, isn't it? Nine Elms, where that big brewery is. That was all from one of the things we did. and we created this law firm. It all was with Thornton Barnes. We had a bank, an old brother family down in Dorset. The family were traders and were interested in the law, interested in making money. Then they all sold up the brewery, and Grandpa headed off to Norfolk, where some of his chums were, and he was a great cricketer, and he played for the Corinthian Casuals at football, and he was, you know, the sporting thing came rolling through. And so he settled in Norfolk about 1907, and was much involved with Norfolk County cricket and with the church and all that sort of jazz. And when the war came, World War I, he joined the 2nd, 6th Norfolk Cyclists, that old and gallant band, that tumbled around Norfolk, getting frozen bloody stiffly right on their bicycles round the coast. And one of his sons, four or five sons, uncles, was old enough to join the 9th Foot, and that was Gordon, who then eventually commanded the Presbyterian. There was another, Jack, who got a military cross in the First War, but was bloody nearly court-martialed, because basically he loved horses, and he was a horse gunner, and the horses got stuck in a minefield, and he rescued the horses, but he cared about the horses far more than anything else, and he bloody well took the horses.
He didn't leave the guns behind.
No, I don't know what happened about the guns, but what he did do is he took the horses back to where they were safe, and the commanding officer wanted to court-martial him for desertion, because he left the lines on to take the horses back to where they were safe. It was only eventually when they discovered what he'd actually done that the court martial turned around and made him into a military cross. But anyhow, that was two who fought in the war, and the third son died in the flying, in the beginnings of the Royal Flying Corps. And my father was then not old enough to do join the war. But there was a strong military tradition there, and very strong links with Norfolk. If you take sport, my uncle's president, my grandfather's president of the Norfolk County Cricket Club, and I've been president of the Norfolk County Cricket Club, Uncle Gordon, brother Mike, and I have played cricket for Norfolk, and I've been capped for Norfolk. So, in a county that loves the traditional sports like cricket and so on, we had a name, and we probably earned it, and we loved it, you know. And so we get Bill Edrich, for instance, you know, started with my grandfather, all that sort of stuff. And my grandfather got him, encouraged him, helped him to get to Middlesex. And Bill Edrich, captain of the North County Cricket Club, captain of the North County Cricket team. I was playing in the team. So lovely how you get your cycles, isn't it?
And close connections.
That's right, lovely connections, and that I come back to that. That Sol Majors came. Same with Bill and me with Grandpa. Grandpa helped him. He, when he was captain, capped me for Norfolk. And these are important sort of parts of the sort of fabric of life. Somebody who has, you know, preferred to serve and was happy to serve in the county of Richmond.
You mentioned that you did service in the ranks. How did that happen? Did you go in as a national service man?
Absolutely. That was just a straightforward, I think, excellent system, whereby every potential officer had to do, I think it was 3 months, in the ranks. A lot of that was spent, for me, in Bury St Edmunds, with the potential leaders platoon, which was itself an experience.
Could you tell me about that, what the potential leaders platoon did that was different from what the other platoons were doing?
Well, first of all, they were supposed to be better than most. And now what I'm going to say may again seem slightly sort of larky, and they were better than most. But they're also very bright and bubbly sort of personalities. And I can recall we had a number of good NCOs. We had one or two who were war worries and from the Suffolks, for instance, and Malaya. And so we get quite an interesting cross-section of corporals and sergeants involved with us.
How many of you were there in this platoon?
I would think 24. Something like that.
And roughly how many would you say were experienced old soldiers as opposed to bright young men coming in?
Ah, they were all bright young men coming in. Trained by one or two excellent NCOs and one or two who were a bit war weary.
Oh, I see. It was the instructors who were the war weary men.
The instructors were a bit war weary. I mean, we certainly learnt a lot about. It was a very good experience because we took them quite hard, but we also were led astray on two occasions by, for instance, you know, one of the corporals. I can well remember him taking us off for a run. We doubled round the barrack wall and got a small distance away, and then we sat down for a requisite time, and then we doubled back into the barracks. Now, this was an interesting sort of reflection on the alternative methods of training. And indeed, I can well recall we had our sort of hut, which we had to keep properly polished up and all that sort of so on, and we did. And we enjoyed doing it. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Nothing like came with smartest boots and, you know. But this particular corporal, who got a military medal in Malaya, he had an excellent system, sort of taking it easy. And the system was that we were out in the trenches in the training area with a long piece of wire, which led to his bunk. And this was affixed to either his toe or finger or whatever it may be. And our task was to keep a lookout for when the officers came along. And we had to tug on them, and he would shoot out of the back of the hut and join us. And we actually weren't too shocked about this. We just noticed it, and we played the game, so to speak. But the other side of it was that there were certain very good officers there, and the chap called Joe Starling, who became a brigadier, who was probably one of the best platoon commanders in the Suffolk Regiment in Malaya. And then he was pretty. His language was the match of any, but he was an excellent trainer and an excellent shot. And so we learnt the other side, which you could see, you know, you could see this contrast of leadership. The chap who'd had enough of it all. I'm just surprised they actually had him with us, but they did, and we noticed. It didn't actually. In a sense, we just took it in a humorous young person's way. We were out to survive and to get through. But if we were trained well, then we really lapped it up. And we got that from Joe Starling. We got it on the range, we got it in shooting, we got it in, you know, the fitness side. And I think that contrast is rather useful.
A dual approach, a dual view of the army, then?
That's a dual view of the army as a reflection of that's, you know, that's the sort of compass of potential leaders and what they do. One was very bad and had enough of it all, and the other was superlative and thriving enthusiasm. And, you know, up to me, lovely contrast.
How long were you in before you went into the potential leaders platoon?
About 3 weeks, and it was up at the depot at Norwich. I remember going in there and feeling sort of that. You feel pretty scared stiff, and you know you're going to go, and that's it. And for the first week, they gave me one of the very few senior soldiers, because it was national service, and this was a regular soldier, private soldier, whose name was Fitch, Private Stitch, who had a wig, perhaps his balls are good. He was bloody good. He was very shy, gentle man, but he taught me how to build boots, he kept an eye on me, he did his job scrupulously. I never forget him, you know. And you get sometimes these people who actually probably could only be in the army if the army would accept them as they were. I don't think he would ever run away. I think he'd been very good on the farm.
How old was this man when you knew him?
28, I think, 27, 28. Yeah. I'm just jumping, but there was a similar sort of character when I was a platoon commander in Germany, and we were practicing the marches for our Maiden. And we liked to do it the way that actually it was a race, not a march, and we did it quite the wrong way, of course. But we used to factory, we used to knock spots of everybody. And one of the guys who used to do these marches with me was, again, a very quiet person, very like Fitch. And I remember going along with him one day, and this guy said very, very little like Fitch. But he's shy. And he turned to me one day and he said, "I like roses." Not the sort of thing you expect a private soldier to say to you. And I thought, if Fitch was there, he'd say, "I like them too." Very similar people. Mm. And really nice, very sensitive, quiet within themselves, needed a home, found it with the army, found it with the regiment.
Were they both from Norfolk?
Yes, they're both Norfolk boys.
Rural origins, do you think?
Probably. I can't recall. But almost certainly. Hmm.
What did they do with you in this first 3 weeks of basic training?
They just taught me to pull my boots, to stand attention, do my bed space properly, all the basics, a little bit of marching, make sure I could step off with the right foot, swing my arms sensibly. Very basic recruit soldier role.
And then you went to the potential leaders. Had you been through any selection process to go to the potential leaders platoon?
Yes. I started off by going to the recruiting office, put my name down, and they then immediately said, "Right, I suppose because of my family background, I haven't done before, and you know, you do IQ tests and you have to do things like that." They said, "Right, this is a potential leader." And so basically I went to the depot, Royal Norfolk, so they could badge me and get me sorted out at Royal Norfolk, because I said that's what I wanted to join. Mm. And then after statutory, it was not more than 3 weeks, and could well have been 2 weeks, off I went, as soon as they were ready to receive me down in Barrison Edmonds, at the, what was then the East Anglian Brigade. It couldn't be the East Anglian Brigade, before me or later. But whatever it was, that was where there was a training centre in the Hutted Camp and Railway Camp. Well, no, not Railway. Whichever the camp was, this Hutted Camp, they had the potential leaders there for several regiments of, you know, so East Anglian foot regiments.
What did they do with you there? You were saying you had good trainers and bad trainers. Was it the basic military syllabus that you would have had as a recruit? Or was there something extra added to it?
Right. The basic military training then was to teach you to march both on the parade ground and the cross country, to map read, and that included use of compass, to understand about hand signals, practice them, be able to dig a trench, to understand about night noises, night vision, about movement at night, to understand your personal weapon and the brain damage of them backwards and blindfold.
The personal weapon, would that be the Lee Enfield?
Then it was the Lee Enfield, yes. I think so. Yeah, bolt action.
10 rounds of the magazine. Yeah, 303.
Yeah. Loved it. Lovely one. Yeah. That was a good shot.
Was there a lot of range work involved in that early period?
Quite a lot. That's why I remember Joe Starling, because he was a very good officer training and shooting. He used to refer to us as hairy ass nignogs, and various other expressions. I remember that very clearly. yeah, plenty of that.
Did you do a lot of training in the classroom, or were you outside for it most of the time?
It was a sensible mix. And we were also, quite rightly, I think, put under pressure on the drill square to react without thinking too much to orders, but also we were put under pressure. And I can remember on one occasion turning right instead of left and being made to double round the square with my steel helmet and rifle above my head, under pressure I could drop. This is as an 18-year-old. And it was quite an experience, and it really upset me. And I can remember the platoon sergeant, Sergeant Charlesworth, who was a very good leader. He knew that actually I had been pushed too hard, and it was wrong. But he didn't say anything about that, but he just showed a little bit of sympathy, which tidied it all away for me. And I thought it was very good touch there. The Sergeant Major had taken it altogether too far. The platoon sergeant found a way of damping it down, and it was quite a good expense for me. Again, that was good leadership, good management, and sort of got the thing back. And the sort of thing that would probably have caused, could have ended up in the newspapers more than ever with me, but today, in the sort of slightly muddled approach of sort of a politically correct society, actually it was very good for me, and it was handled splendidly by the main actor, who was the platoon sergeant, who brought it all back to ground quite quickly. And I respected him for it. And I was pleased that I hadn't actually collapsed, because it was hot. And it was the sort of thing that actually, you'd just been taken too far. Taught me a lesson too about taking things too far.
What about the discipline generally? Did you find it difficult or easy to adjust to being under?
Very easy. Very easy. Because everything was about teamwork. And you worked as teams, and you tried like mad, and you had competitions, and you enjoyed competitions, by the way. There's nothing more invigorating than a good competition. And some of you win, and some of you lose, and you learn how to handle not winning, and then finding ways of making sure the next time you do.
But was all the training organised on the basis of being competitive? Was that done to provide motivation?
And I think it's an excellent way. In fact, it's fundamental to keeping our eyes constant process of competition, and where there's a high chance of winning something.
You mentioned digging trenches. Mm. Was there a lot of that?
Not a lot, but sufficient to tell you that it was a back-aching business, and you need to give us the time to do it. It wasn't until I came back for a short spell as a platoon commander at the depot and started to train young soldiers that I actually got into some of the more sophisticated aspects of digging trenches.